Hello again, Meg World. Welcome to another Meg podcast. Once again, I've got Richard Jeffrey Cook and Matt Haywood here. And this time we're going to have a look at the Southeast Asia PDF from the Army Lists, and look at some of the armies therein, and indeed some of their enemies as well. So a couple of those are going to get a look in. We thought we'd just expand it beyond the PDF just to expand the variety of armies we could look at. I think it's probably safe to say that this is one of those PDFs that I'll stick my neck out and say most gamers out there don't know too much about either the history or the armies, and I'd certainly include myself in that. I'm just laughing because what do you mean only most? I think that was his comment. It's certainly an area that I think it's fair to say getting information in, you know, for those of us in the Anglophone world is quite difficult. I suspect it's a bit easier for the Francophone world. So that counts me out for sure. So, yeah, hopefully we will learn something. Richard is going to give us some historical notes on this. You know, as we're not going to try and we didn't ask him to sort of inflict on him to give us the whole history of Southeast Asia from the beginning of recorded history to the end of the Meg period. So Richard has gone away and he produced some highlights, which I'm sure will be of great interest. And then after that, we'll look at some army lists. So in that case, to kick us off, Richard, over to you for some historical notes.
Thank you, Nick, and good evening, everyone. So Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia has actually been a maritime trading route with India and China since at least 1500 BCE, which is a long time ago. And so as a result, the area has been had a basis, I suppose, for economic and cultural growth really ever since this time. And along with that, it received both Hindu and Buddhist beliefs that arrived from India due to this trade, and obviously much later on was to receive Islamic input into their cultural mix as well. So I'll work my way around the nations of Southeast Asia, and I'll start with Vietnam. So Bronze Age in Vietnam arrived around 500 BC, and sort of shortly after that, we have the sort of first Vietnamese kingdom referred to as the Van Lang Kingdom. I'll apologise now for my pronunciations of Southeast Asian words, because I really am not sure how some of them should be pronounced, but I'll do my best. So at this time, the Van Lang Kingdom actually seems to have been an early adopter of archery, because a legend refers to a crossbow that could fire thousands of bolts simultaneously, perhaps referring to volley fire of the infantry. And I have been fortunate enough to visit the museum in Hanoi, where they have examples of early crossbows mechanisms, and they were being mass produced even at a very early period in the sort of 2nd, 3rd century BCE. So, yeah, it seems that missile fire was an important aspect of Vietnamese warfare even around this time. So in about 257 BCE, the Van Lang were actually subsumed by invaders from the south, who are referred to as the O Viet. And their kingdom, the O Lac, emerges with a capital at Chiloa, which is referred to as a fortress with many concentric walls. So showing that fortifications were quite advanced even at this early stage. Now, in 207 BCE, the former Qin general Zhao Tu, he establishes the kingdom of Nam Viet, referred to in Chinese as Nanwei, along China's southern coast. And in 197, he then annexes the kingdom of Olac. Now, interestingly, this is regarded as a Vietnamese kingdom as opposed to a Chinese kingdom, although there is quite a matter of debate amongst the historians. So then in the next big event is in 111 BCE, when the Han dynasty actually invade Nanwei, and they establish Chinese domination over Vietnam. This domination was really to continue right up to 938 in the Common Era, interrupted by the Trung sisters' rebellion of 40 to 43 CE, and the Van Chuan or early Li dynasty that actually broke away and ruled from 544 to 602 in the sort of period before the Sui-Chinese re-established Chinese rule. So from 908, the Vietnamese region is governed as an autonomous state, but it still actually pays tribute to the later Liang dynasty. This is after the fall of the Tang dynasty of sort of 20 years earlier, really. And from this date onwards, Vietnam actually remains independent until 1862, when the colonial French imposed rule. In 1075, the Viet, learning that a Song invasion is imminent, actually preempt that and attack the south coast of China, inflicting damage on the Song. And in the following year, they actually defeat the Song at the Battle of Nguyet. I have no idea how you pronounce Nguyet. Suggestions on a postcard, please. Anyway, it's the river. Nguyet or something. That to this day is actually recognized as an important Vietnamese victory. The Cham nation actually revolt in 192 CE. This is again from the Chinese domination, and they establish the Champa kingdom. Meanwhile, on the lower Mekong, further south still and slightly to the west, the Funan kingdom emerges as the first Khmer state. Those dates from 68 CE right through to 627. There is actually, while I was staying in Vietnam, I did actually see there are coins originating in the Roman Empire that have been found in South Vietnam, showing that the trade actually extended as far as the Roman Empire. But Funan itself is actually overthrown by the Zenla kingdom, which gets subsumed into the Yanka Empire. Meanwhile, in 605, the Sui Empire, who had just reconquered northern Vietnam, actually invaded the Cham and looted many Cham sanctuaries. This invasion actually appears to have the effect of unifying the Cham, initially under King Sambuvarman. Hope I've got that right. And Champa actually enters a golden age as a Buddhist kingdom, with the Cham controlling the trade routes really from China right through to the Abbasids at Baghdad. In 982, actually, the Vietnamese invade, and a usurper seizes the throne. And then a new Hindu Cham kingdom is actually established slightly further south. The Champa and the emerging Anka Empire then sort of end up engaging in a war between the 10th and 13th centuries. Major invasions occur in 950, 1080, 1145, 1149, and 1177. The Khmer actually conquer the Cham in 1203 and rule until 1220, when they actually leave, putting a Cham prince, Ang Saraja, in charge, who restores Cham independence. The Champa, interestingly, and Khmer cooperate both in 1128 and 1132, invading the Vietnamese. The Mongols themselves then invade Vietnam in 1258, 1285, and 1287 to 88. On all three occasions, the invasions were repelled. Basically, the Vietnamese technique in fighting the Mongols was basically to abandon their cities, head up to the mountains, and then fight the Mongols in the jungles and swamps of Vietnam. The climate also assisted the Vietnamese, with the Mongols falling to various diseases that presumably the Vietnamese themselves were much more resistant to. The Battle of Bach Dang in 1288 saw the Huan fleet decimated, and after that time, the Huan no longer attempt to invade Vietnam. During this period, the Vietnamese themselves actually advanced southwards, and Champa becomes a tributary state sometime between 1312 and 1322. The Cham themselves then wage a counterattack from 1370 until 1390, until a naval offensive was halted by the Vietnamese through the use of cannon. So there's a fairly firm date for the introduction of gunpowder cannon to Vietnam. In 1407, the Ming actually invade Vietnam, and they actually sort of dominate the country for the next 20 years until independence is restored. The Vietnamese then again expand southwards, ending the Champa Kingdom for good in 1471. And that's sort of is the point at which the Vietnamese control not only current North Vietnam, but move down the middle of Vietnam into the southern Mekong Delta. Meanwhile, the Khmer Empire and its 6 centuries from the 7th to the 13th centuries really mark the apogee of Southeastern Asian pre-industrial civilizations. The water management of the Khmer guaranteed a huge food surplus. Essentially, they could get 3 crops a year due to the climate and their water management. And this huge food surplus permits a huge monument building and indeed infrastructure maintenance. This allows the empire to reach its greatest extent under Suryavarman II in the mid-12th century. The Khmer Empire itself collapses by the third decade of the 14th century, with Siam appearing to be the primary nemesis in the demise of Anka. But other factors may well include climate change, very popular at the moment. There's theories for extinction of civilizations, other factors including the prevalence of Buddhism and the sort of its strictures against military action are also claimed to be a part. Again, I was lucky enough to visit Angkor Wat, which is absolutely superb, and I heartily recommend if you ever get the chance to visit. Meanwhile, Let's move towards Siam. The Thai peoples initially referred to as TAI. The H seems to get added later. I've never quite figured out why or where. They originate actually in Guangxi in southern China. Perhaps prompted by Chinese expansion and a failed rebellion in 722, they actually start migrating southwest. In the 860s, they actually sided with Nanzhao, again against the Chinese. And as late as 1040s, they were raising a revolt against the Song in Nanning. The Thai themselves seem to have adopted Buddhism around 800, and they established a capital at Chiang Saen, which I think is sort of near the border between Laos and Thailand, but I could be wrong there. Around 900, the Mon had captured Chiang Saen, and certainly by 1100, the Thai were moving southwards. And as the Khmer weakened, they established the Sukhothai kingdom in 1238, in what we would recognize now as modern Thailand, reaching a peak in 1365, although they would be eventually overthrown by the Ayutthaya kingdom. This would create a golden age in Thailand and actually would last until 1767. The earliest civilization in Burma were the Pui, who established city-states from the 2nd century BCE. And by the early 9th century in the Common Era, they were coming under constant attacks from the Nanzhao. These attacks allowed the Burmans, who were sort of settled up in the upper part of Burma, to expand and establish the pagan empire in 1044. The Mongols invaded in 1277, and they sacked Pagan, the capital itself, in 1287. This sort of leading to the Shan overthrowing the Pagan Empire 10 years later. The Pagan Empire itself would be replaced by Shan states in the north of Burma, by the Ava Kingdom in the sort of middle, and to the south, the Mon Hanthawaddy Kingdom. Meanwhile, the northern Mekong valleys, which had been occupied by the Khmer and the Mon. In the 13th century, and with the rise of the Sukhothai kingdom, they came increasingly under the influence of the Thai. In 1316, a king of Muang Sua, which was a sort of city-state in Laos, sent his grandson to the court of the Khmer Empire. In 1349, he was granted an army known as the 10,000, and he actually started a campaign in southern Laos in 1353, where he established the Lan Xang Kingdom, which apparently translates or is known as the land of the million elephants and a white parasol.
A million elephants.
There's your army.
Crowded.
This quickly expanded actually to become one of the largest kingdoms in Southeast Asia. By 1402, it had received formal recognition from the Ming Empire. In 1421, it helped the Ming suppress a rebellion. And between 1479 and 1480, it was engaged in a war with the Vietnamese. And although the Lan capital was sacked, the Vietnamese were expelled and would not invade again for 200 years. And to prevent the next question, no, we don't currently have a Lan Zhang list. And yes, we probably should.
With a million elephants.
Maybe an exaggeration, I don't know. Anyway, that's my summary of Southeast Asian history. I've specifically excluded the Nanzhao, who could be regarded as Chinese, And I left out the Indonesians and Malay because I thought they could be done perhaps another time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Richard. And I didn't envy you at all with having having pronunciation issues on any of that. I think, you know, it's you know, obviously for those of us living where we are in Britain, these are really quite different names, aren't they? So, to say the least.
Indeed.
It is, yeah. So a possible new list at some stage.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously, yes, not with a million elephants, but Bruno suggests that elephants were distinctly was that a major part of the.
That seems quite likely, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yes. And then again, that's fairly typical of Southeast Asia. So, just as you're going through your history notes there, Richard, it did strike me that I think some of the dates didn't quite seem to sit with the ones we've got in the lists at the moment. I think you mentioned the Cham seemed to pop up earlier than the Champa list starts, and also I think Thai was another one that seemed to be, at least as a possibly an allied contingent, were around a bit earlier than our list suggests.
I think that's probably the case. I think part of it is a lack of information from which to create the army lists. But I think, yes, there probably is some tweaking that could be done to the lists and the dates and possibly even some of the allied contingents as well. Yes.
Play around, yeah. One of the things that did strike me from what you said was just, because you mentioned like the Roman coins and control of trade routes as far as Baghdad. That just seems far more connected westward than I would have expected.
I think that this is a aspect of perhaps the influence of colonialism on history. And the fact that we tend to underestimate the extent of trade networks and indeed how early some of these trade networks were established. So I think we perhaps are familiar with sort of the Roman trade network to Ceylon and southern India.
Yeah.
But I think, yes, the sort of trade routes from Arabia through to round India and then across to Southeast Asia, I think, tend to get underestimated. And indeed, the role of the Chola Empire in India as well was very significant. And the Chola had a big influence right across Thailand, the Khmer Empire, and as far north as the Cham.
Right. So, yeah. Wow. So, learning about interconnectedness as well. Okay. Well, again, thank you. I don't know if Matt's got anything he would like to comment on that.
I was just pondering a million elephants and just how big a big battle that had to be to get them on the table.
How long you'd take to paint them.
Well, especially
Robin would take about 3 weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There you are, Robin, when you listen to this. A million elephants. Yeah, figure manufacturer somewhere going, we'll never cast them in time.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now that we've got Matt up and running, I think we'll move on to army lists. I'm going to ask Matt to do some. Matt has produced as a matching pair, a pair who fought each other. So we'll ask Matt to go through those two first. I'll let him choose which order he does them in and introduce them. So Matt, over to you for some army lists.
Okie doke. Well, I've gone with the 10 Kingdoms Chinese Southern Han out of the Tang Dynasty, Tang Chinese PDF, and the Autonomous Vietnamese from Southeast Asia books. So I'll start with the Chinese, I think. Let's start with the villain of the piece, allegedly. okay, so Ten Kingdoms Southern Han. This is an army list that's broken up into, well, I think you can do 9 out of the 10 kingdoms with this list. So Southern Han is the one that actually fought the Vietnamese, so that's the one I've gone with. It's a pretty standard Chinese list. You have professional generals. You are allowed up to 3 internal allied generals of various types, which is quite interesting. The terrain is standard mountains and jungle. You can have an unfortified or a fortified camp. So that's the basic outline. Let's leap straight in. You can have optional war elephants, and they are superior. So despite what I said in the last podcast about me and elephants, I've taken 3 superior elephants. So that's my first duck. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So anyway, competent professional generals, 4 of them. One of them is an internal ally. It's adequate, I think. Gives you 12 cards. But anyway, we'll discuss that in a minute. It gives you a PBS of 7 and a scouting of 3. For a Chinese army, it's quite big in that it's 11 tugs, so it breaks on a 6. Says something about the quality of the troops in it, mind you, but again, we'll get on to that. I've gone with the unfortified camp because it was a few more points than I could afford for the fortified one. So as I said, the spoiler from earlier, war elephants, superior. 1 tug off 3 of them. The basic tribal loose, superior protected shove. Nothing fancy like escorting troops or anything, just 3 nasty elephants. I then have 2 tugs of cavalry. Now, these are cavalry formed loose, average protected, experienced bow, short spear, melee expert. I really like them. You have an option to upgrade 4 of them to superior, but I think 6 average melee expert is probably more to my taste, shall we say. Maximum number of cavalry the list can have. It's a very infantry orientated army. So there you go. 2 tugs of 6 cavalry. You then have the standard Chinese mixed tug units of spearmen and archers. So the front ranks are infantry formed flexible, average protected, experienced bow, short spear, and the rear ranks are just experienced bow loose. So I've taken 3 blocks of 8s. So 4 front, 4 back ranks. Yeah, not much to say, Ben. You can't upgrade them to crossbow. Yeah, well, they're not exciting, but you can't upgrade them to crossbow, which is unfortunate. I think crossbows are very much value added in those formations. Also very much expensive in those formations, but nevertheless, there you go. Then there are 2 tugs of what I actually think is quite an interesting troop type, which you don't see, I don't think, in many of the Chinese army. They're called Vanguard Swordsmen, and they're infantry, formed flexible, average protected, short spear, melee expert. 2 blocks of 8. Yeah, they're interesting. I like those. I've then taken 2 blocks of 6 crossbowmen. Pretty much full fat as crossbowmen go. They're formed loose, average, protected, experienced crossbow. They're not combat shy. Yeah, so 2 sixes of those. And to round off the tugs, there's a raw militia archer unit, which is... I actually don't think I could have got it any worse. It's infantry, tribal loose, poor, unprotected, unskilled bow, combat shy, 6 of them, but for a massive 102 points. So, you know, yeah, that's value for money as far as I'm concerned. And then 2 skirmishing units, 1 skirmishing archers, which are infantry skirmishers, poor, unprotected, unskilled bow, combat shy, group 6. Horse archers, cavalry skirmisher, poor, unprotected, experienced bow, combat shy, group 6. Horse archers are purely there. Well, they might be a bonus from the shooting as they're still experienced bow, but they are really purely there to drop me over into 3 scouting. 2, I think, is a bit, yeah. And the skirmishing archers are to stand in front of my superior elephants because the last thing I want is some sod shooting them before they get to stomp on something, quite frankly. So that's the ablative screen to go in front of the elephants. There you go. That's it. It's not really exciting, but, you know, superior war elephants.
How do you think you would normally try and use it, Matt?
The entirety of the army is basically rough going troops. I mean, the archers and the spearmen can stand in the open because they're form flexible, but I'd be looking to smear the table in rough going, quite frankly. The elephants don't care. The cavalry make a nice block to attack with. I actually might even combine them with the elephants, quite frankly. It's a bit of a bizarre mix, but I think that might work quite well. plenty of shooting. The Vanguard swordsmen, two tugs of those on the attack, along with the elephant as well. That's about as far as I get in my tactical thinking with that one. It's not going to be doing a lot of manoeuvring, I don't think. It can go quite deep, though, I suppose, with those archer spearmen units and take a lot of punishment whilst you work a flank. But yeah, terrain would be its friend, I think.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I have to say, I like the Vanguard swordsmen. People with long memories remember I used an early Northern Song army, Ice and Fire, a few years ago, and that had those troops in. It's sort of a northern version of this a bit later on, because it gets crossbowmen instead of archers in the mixed unit. And the Vanguard swordsmen can be really good. They're good, tough units, they're innates. I think that those, if you're looking for the punch bit of it, it looks to me it's them, the elephants, obviously, and the cavalry are very capable. So, yeah. Richard, initial thoughts?
Yeah, I like it. It's reminds me of the Tang army I used in open competitions. Obviously, the Tang army doesn't have the elephants. It has a bit of punchy cavalry, perhaps, instead. But, it looks quite a good army to me.
Yeah. I think it's one of those that when you put it down, your opponent might go, well, what is there to scare me? But it's actually better than that.
Its punch is quite dangerous, and its stodge is stodge. It's going to stand there for quite a while, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And certainly in an Eastern theme, which is obviously what this podcast is about, really. looking at Eastern armies in its own context, there's not a lot that's going to run it over, really. So, shall we move on to its opponent?
The hero of the piece, allegedly.
The army that's going to run away into the mountains and
that's the one.
Jungles and swamps.
Yeah. Autonomous Vietnamese. It's a list that exists for 32 years, apparently, 906 to 938. So, I picked the shortest time span I could find. it's an interesting list. Shall we put it at that?
We could just leave it at that, Matt, if you want.
possibly wise, given my choice of armies and lists. But no, it's interesting in a couple of reasons. It's purely instinctive generals. You can have three instinctive subgenerals, but you can also have three internal instinctive allies. I have a theory. I don't actually think it's possible to use all three internal allies. I don't think the troop numbers and the points allow you to do it in the 10,000 point army. But that's by the by. We can maybe discuss that later. Anyway, so it's standard coastal and jungle for its terrain. Camp has to be unfortified. It can be poor on average. It's a complex list in the sense that you can have court troops, which I presume is the standing army of the day. You can have militia troops, which I'm assuming is some combat experience, boys that get dragged in to fight for it. And then you can have tribal troops as well. It's an interesting list because the tribal troops actually do not get prescribed as only being available to a tribal ally. They can be commanded by Vietnamese generals. That's where this list has its big problem when you're trying to work it out, is because as soon as you take the tribal, the minimums for the tribal have to go into the main army. So if you want a tribal ally, you've already got to give a large chunk of his tribal troops to the main list. So there you go. I'll show you what I came up with.
Okay. I'm getting confused already.
Sorry. Well, all right. Okay.
Carry on, Matt. I'll just think.
I'll read the list out first and I'll tell you what I mean. So, while I've gone with a talented instinctive army commander, just to boost the PBS up slightly, because I think if you can get to six minimum, you're all right. It's got two competent instinctive subgenerals, and it's a hill tribe ally competent instinctive for the last one. You come out with PBS of six, scouting of two. I don't actually think, short of a legendary general, it's possible to get the scouting above three. in this list, because they have one unit of cavalry and 18 skirmishers, and that's it in the entirety of the list. So anyway, the tugs to break is 8. It's an army of 15 tugs. Yeah. And it also has 3 skirmishing units, which gives you 18 for deployment. So 6 go down in the thirds. Yeah, there's a lot of it here. Right, so first two tugs are elephants. Elephants, tribal loose, average protected, shove in twos. I know, never put your elephants in twos, but there's a reason for that, and I will explain it at the end.
Oh, method in the madness, and possibly madness in the
madness
method.
In the method, I think, is much more likely. But anyway, and then there's the court cavalry. These are not compulsory, but as I say, it's the only cavalry in the army, so you might as well take them, just to have something that moves more than 3, besides your elephants. Cavalry formed loose, average protected, experienced javelin, short spear. And I've made them combat shy.
Okay.
6. Then you have court halberdiers. These are infantry formed, flexible, superior protected, 6. You can't have any more than 6, so 6 it is. Then we have the court archers. They are infantry formed loose, average, unprotected, experienced bow, combat shy, 6 of those. I'm not actually intending to fight with them, to be perfectly honest. And then we get into the tribal troops. Now, the tribal troops are tribal axemen and spearmen. That's what they're described as. And they are infantry, tribal loose, average, protected, unskilled javelin, melee expert, shoot and charge. I have taken 3 blocks of 9. They're interesting troop types. You then have the list has 18 of those as compulsory, by the way. So you have to take 18 if you take those. Tribal crossbowmen, which are infantry, tribal loose, average, unprotected, experienced crossbow. I've taken 2 blocks of 8, 1 block of 6, and the block of 6 I've made combat shy. Again, you have to have a minimum of 12 in the list, and up to many, many more.
12 to many.
Yes, that's right. You run out of points before you run out of bases, I think. Then the militia troops. Now, you have militia crossbowmen. 8 of these are compulsory, so these are the compulsory 8. They are infantry, formed loose, average, unprotected, experienced crossbow. Block of 8. Not combat shy, they're just unprotected. Then we get into the militia spearmen. Now, this is quite an interesting list, because you have to take 9. You can have up to 32. But there are then 2 optional upgrades. 1 to upgrade up to a third to militia spearmen with axes. That makes them melee expert. And then up to a third can be upgraded to superior, but not the melee expert. So what you end up with is militia spearmen who standardly are infantry, formed loose, average, protected, unskilled javelin, short spear, with an option to combat shy, which I have taken for the compulsory 8. I've taken 8 and I've made them combat shy, and I've also made them poor. So the bog standard militia spearmen I've downgraded as much as I can. I've then taken the 8 with axes, so the average melee expert, we shoot and charge. And then I've taken the superior veterans, who are just protected, unskilled javelin, short spear. I don't think they can have... Oh, yes, they can have shoot and charge. So if I could find the points, I'd probably give them shoot and charge as well. And that is all 15 tugs. So... The problem with this list, as I was saying, is if you took all Allied generals, for example, the army commander would have to command the court halberdiers, he would have to command the court archers, he would have to command 18 of the tribal axemen, he would have to command 12 of the crossbowmen, because they're the minimums that the main army has to command. He would also have to command 8 militia crossbowmen, he would also have to command a minimum of 9 of the militia spearmen, leaving you not very much to give to any of the other internal Allied generals. So you're a bit. So even if you take one subject, it gets very complicated. I have a feeling the list may have meant to say that, you know, the main army doesn't have to have the tribals, possibly. I don't know. It makes the numbers quite odd.
I should refer to Richard at this point, see what his thoughts on that are.
I think something's gone wrong in terms of the intention.
You're not quite sure at the moment what it is.
I'm wondering if optionally the Vietnamese generals can command the tribal axemen, but they don't have to take, the main army doesn't have to take a minima. I don't know. That's kind of the impression I got when I read it. But
there's been it's one of those armies I probably should have looked at. Well, there are the Vietnamese armies I've never been entirely happy with, I have to admit. But it's not a period I've known enough about to have been confident to make any corrections. I think the Hill tribesmen perhaps should, I think you're right, perhaps the intention from the list author, who wasn't me, was that Hill tribesmen shouldn't be compulsory in the main army. I don't know. I think it's one of it's on my list, to-do list, so to speak.
I have nothing I could contribute to that. I will, however, say for the listeners, please go to the blog and look at the show notes for this list especially, because Matt has, I'm looking at the list now, Matt has very kindly color-coded the troops to generals, and I've been looking at it while Matt's been talking about us through it, and yeah, it's I just can't get my head around it, quite frankly, but
it's a mirage of color, shall we leave it at that?
It is, yeah. I'll just say you've also got three skirmisher units.
Yes, I forgot to mention that. Three skirmishers, which are skirmisher poor, unprotected, unskilled javelins, combat shy, three blocks of six. One of them's experienced javelin, though. And now I've realized I've missed shoot and charge off the superior militia. I would probably drop them back down to unskilled and put the shoot and charge onto the superior. So they're all basically going to be unskilled javelin. I did it mostly because it was a list that I'd never ever seen anybody try to field, and I'm beginning to see why.
You might just have found out why from your description of the.
My theoretical thinking on how it would work is you use the melee expert tribal or the superior. You basically use all your spearmen that have melee expert or superior as your front ranks, but you intersperse all the crossbowmen in between them. So it's, you know, crossbowmen, spearmen, and the crossbowmen in deep. So two wide, whether they're eights or sixes, and go forward. The theory being that anybody who wants to charge the spearmen has to take crossbows in the face as they come in. It also means that cavalry that like to charge into infantry and break off then have to repeat the process with the crossbowmen in the face, particularly if they're contacting them. They're getting the wound on the S and things like that. So that makes it less attractive. None of the crossbowmen that I'd have in the front rank are combat shy. My main reason for that is it keeps you throwing dice if they end up as overlaps, because short of being charged by a fully armored knight who's superior, fully armored, and melee expert, even if your opponent is throwing reds, you've still got the superior, fully armored, melee expert cavalry will push over into red, white, because you're unprotected. The cream of some armies will do you a lot of pain, but if you're throwing bucket loads of white dice, I'm thinking that with a break of eight, there's a strong chance I'm going to take 10 points off an opponent before they kill me. The elephants, before I forget, are in twos simply because I'm intending to have them behind the battle lines. So if you break a unit of mine, I'm hoping that you've taken some damage and then you're going to pile into an elephant. Elephants throwing white dice for being a cab test for being broken through, or a cab test for a friendly unit routing, means they're unlikely to use a base before you contact them. That's the theory. I think a single block of four doesn't do the army much good. I think two blocks of two on either flank or on either side of the center the cavalry there for scouting, to be honest. Other than that, superior halberdiers offer you a slight punch if you can get them around the flank or something. But yeah, it's stodge with a lot of shooting because everything's got a missile weapon, basically, by the elephants. That's a lot of dice.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's, I was say, it's not my sort of army.
It's not mine, to be honest.
I applaud you for bringing the list to the podcast because it is interesting. It's massively loose, isn't it? I think this is a terrain is its friend, obviously.
Yeah. Another reason for the talented instinctive general to try and help control the terrain.
Yeah, Richard.
Yeah, I think I've actually used this army once in a friendly game, and the challenge is trying to get the bits to work together. I sort of seem to remember I was fortunate in that my opponent was overly focused on individual units and didn't actually operate their army as a coherent whole, and I actually think I won the game as a result.
Right.
It's not a list I could imagine myself taking to any sort of event, friendly or otherwise, to be honest.
Yeah.
Not that I've got Vietnamese figures, so that would probably be a reason why I wouldn't take it anyway.
Yeah. Mind you, I'm not sure you can get Vietnamese figures, but I think as Matt just said, it's got a stodge factor, hasn't it? I mean, you know, if you didn't get enough terrain to be happy with, at least a lot of those units are quite big. You know, you've got tribal axemen and spearmen in nines, lots of things in eights. So, as you said, Matt, rolling buckets of white dice is, you know, you got some sixes in there. In fact, your court troops are sixes, aren't they?
But... Yeah, they're more the flexible reserve almost. They're not something I'd be putting in the front rank. But I have just realised there are no compulsory mounted units for this army, so it could actually be taken to foot sloggers. I'm not sure.
Right.
I'm
that not sure I'm that brave. Rich is now puzzled, but if the cavalry aren't and elephants aren't compulsory, you're quite right. Mm. So it's big. It's big. It's one of those win through attrition ones. But as you also say, it's got a reasonable number. It's got 1, 2, 3, 4 loads of crossbowmen, or is it 5? Four crossbowmen and the court archers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 24 of the crossbowmen, I'd say, are true front rankers because they're in eights and they're not that shy. But yeah, you've got 30 crossbowmen, 6 archers, and everything else has got javelins.
Yeah. I think, just taking Richard's comments, the game he had, you know, it's that deceptive. You look at it and go, oh, this will be easy. And then an hour and a half in, you go, well, why have I lost 2 units and he's lost none? And if you don't sort of focus because of that sheer size.
And the melee expert on the infantry means most of the infantry that you end up getting into, you're probably on greens, green.
You know, and the protected melee expert, aren't they?
Yeah. So, you know, if you can get in to something that's not the key of an enemy army, you know, it's not their punch.
Yeah.
You might actually. But as Richard says, it's command and control. It's most of it's going to be mixed tribal and formed. So it's going to be a nightmare to maneuver.
It is, yeah. But, you know, equally, if you look at it against that 10 Kingdoms army, looking at it as the matched pair concept, if you like, those protected melee experts into that Chinese infantry, other than the vanguard swordsmen, you know, could get messy for those spearmen and archer units.
And the vanguard spearmen are still on greens. It's just still a
they're no better, are they? You know, and if you do get a good chunk of terrain, you guess where those two cavalry units are going to be. You know, so if you're playing that as a match pair, although it's not my sort of army, I'd probably be happy enough to use it against the Ten Kingdoms. Richard?
I wouldn't. I'd probably still prefer to use the Ten Kingdoms, but I'm not sure I'd necessarily be successful, as you say.
Well, that's because you're a control freak, Richard, and it's the professional journalist.
Probably, yes.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. Yeah, as I said, I would, you know, for the listeners out there, even if you don't necessarily normally look at the blog for the lists, although I hope you do, but some are easier to follow than others. One, I think the autonomous Vietnamese one is, it's probably difficult to follow just from a description of it because it's so weird and wacky. And as I said, the color coding on the on the army list does show Matt's command decisions as well. So I think that's, I would say definitely go and look at that. Okay, Matt, thank you very much, especially that Vietnamese one. It was fascinating in its own peculiar and unusual way. So, in a desperate attempt to apply some sanity to the situation, I'm going to go next with, I'm going to go with the Nan Zhao, which is one that Richard didn't cover. He mentioned them, but didn't cover in the history, because as he says there, they're sort of quite close up to China. They're a bit pseudo-Chinese in many respects. So, but it's an army I've got the figures for, although I will say I've never actually taken it to a competition yet, for whatever reason, but I have played with it a few times. So here we go. It's an army with four competent professional generals. One of them is a Tang China Southern ally. So they are that close to China. They even allied with them from time to time. Nan Zhao only gets standard terrain, and I've got a poor unfortified camp. It's dated 739 for what it's worth, because the Tang ally is only allowed for a certain amount of time. So I've got four competent generals, army commander, two subs, and an ally. The army comprises of two units of Nan Zhao cavalry, and both of these are cavalry formed loose, superior protected, unskilled bow, short spear. The unskilled bow is a downgrade from experienced bow. Partly a points issue, partly that's why in some ways I want to use them as reasonably offensive troops and not get tied up with a shooting match on those. I've got a four base unit of tribal cavalry, because four bases are compulsory in the army list. These again have been downgraded because I don't have much use for them. Cavalry, fort flexible, poor unprotected, unskilled bow, and combat shy. So they're only 39 points a pop. I'll be honest, I've only got them in because they're compulsory. If I didn't have to have them, I probably wouldn't. Then I've got two units of what are undoubtedly, in my view, the best troops in the Nan Zhao part of the army, the Fupei Guard. These are infantry, drilled flexible, superior protected, long spear. Two units each of eight bases. So I think they're really, really good troops. Superior long spear and the flexible, who cares about terrain? Then I've got two units of spearmen, they're called unarmored spearmen, but half of them can be upgraded. So I've done that. Again, I've got 2/8 of these. The upgraded, quote, unarmored spearmen are infantry, form flexible, average protected long spear. So they're sort of weaker versions of the Fupei Guard. So the unarmored doesn't really apply to those because obviously they're protected. And then I've got one of those confusing descriptions. And then a unit of the base ones, which are fort flexible, average, unprotected, experienced, javelin, short spear. Again, an 8. And then got a unit of archers, because again, they are compulsory, if I remember rightly. Oh, I'm just going to check this. I'm sure the only reason I've got these.
They are.
That's it. It's either because they're compulsory or wanted filler. They are infantry formed loose, poor, unprotected, unskilled bow combat shy. So, you know, like Matt mentioned in his Ten Kingdoms army with his militia spearmen, these are also downgraded as much as they can. Alas, they're formed, so they're more expensive. But that's the way it goes. So that's the Nanzhao part of the army. And then I've got a three-tug ally, starting with a unit of guard spearmen, infantry drilled flexible, superior protected, experienced bow, short spear, melee expert. I think they're rather nice. Six bases. You can't have eight, otherwise I'd have eight. So six bases of those. And then two units of troops, very similar to Matt's mixed formations, being eight bases in total, four bases of infantry form flexible, average protected, experienced bow, short spear, but these are also melee expert, backed by four bases of just formed loose, average protected, experienced bow. So I say I've got two 8 base units of those. So all those Chinese come with melee expert. And that's it. Not a massive army, I suppose. It's 11 tugs, comes out with a PBS of 7, scouting of only 2. It is what it is. I think, you know, ideally I would have liked to get it to 3, but things didn't work out. I've got 5 superior units there, the 2 cavalry, 3 infantry, 2 of which are the Fu Pei Guard, 2, one of which is the Guard Spearman from the Tang China Southern list. So again, like I think like a lot of the armies in the Southeast Asia book, it quite likes terrain, but equally because they've got quite a lot of flexible there, it doesn't mind if it's not too, you know, if it's not too terrainy. The army isn't overly wide. It could do with narrowing the table a bit. But overall, I think the bits can work well together. The Chinese part throws out a reasonable amount of shooting and is fairly capable in melee. Because again, they say they're form flexible and they've got melee expert. The guard spearmen especially, I think, can be very tough. And I think as a unit, that's featured in at least one of Richard's armies when he's fielded Tang armies. So
it has, anyway, yes.
Anyway, that's what I brought for the Nanzhao. So partly, I do have the army, partly because I came across the figures, which are from Eureka Miniatures, and I think they're very nice. So that was part of the reason for doing it. That's the Nanzhao side, and I use Outpost miniatures for the Chinese, although you can't get them anymore. Okay, guys, that's the Nanzhao.
Yeah. Oh,
it's the traditional silence.
As you take it in, yes.
Yes.
I'm not sure it's an army I'm not hugely convinced by the cavalry component. So what you're left with is quite a strong infantry army with a weaker cavalry component, I suppose. I'm just wondering whether opponents are going to sort of put something to occupy the infantry and then try and work around the cavalry flanks, or if you've got the cavalry in reserve, how does that work?
One thing that the list can have, but I didn't take it, is allowed some elephants. Yeah, tying in Southeast Asia. But you can only have 3. The average protected experience both shove, so you'd be, you know, you're looking about 260 points each for a 3 base unit. I've got the models for them, but I'm not quite sure how they fit in. Puzzling. Matt, any thoughts while Richard continues to try and work out what this is all about?
I have to say, as you were reading it out, I was thinking, is he sure it's not one of my lists? because, you know, downgraded cavalry and, you know, unskilled bow on your horse archers and that kind of thing. I really like it. It's an army I would get on with, I think. I love the fact that all the long spear are flex. That has some really interesting possibilities. And I think the Tang ally is a definite value add across the board. No, I like it. It's definitely my style.
Yeah. In the ally, it could also have a Tibetan ally, an early Tibetan ally, which in previous years would have meant thinking about the dismounted cataphracts there, you know, the fully armored long spear integral shooter chaps. But of course, they're no longer available since history intervened in the shape of Mr. Geoffrey Cook here, and one, restricting their availability in the early list and denying them to any allied contingents. And if you look to take cataphracts, essentially you get, it's almost like you get two units of cataphracts instead of that Tang ally. And I just don't think that works, quite frankly.
I think the Tang ally gives you the reach out and touch for enemy cavalry. Yes. It counters a bit of the fact that you don't have that much cavalry. But superior cavalry in sixes are still quite chunky boys, as far as I'm concerned, particularly when working with that kind of infantry, because all that long spear floating around, they're not going to want to play with your cavalry unless you stick them right out on the ledge and just say, you know, come get me. And your skirmishing troops, so you've still got the ability to skirmish away, so they're still not necessarily going to catch you. And sometimes it's a tiger by the tail with superior cavalry. You catch superior cavalry running, skirmishing away, actually it turns into a pretty brutal fight. So, no, yeah, definite thumbs up for me for that one.
Yeah, I said I have used it in, you know, just in one-off games, and it is, I have found it a little bit of not quite the sum of its parts. Mind you, I have tended to use it with the elephant unit and only one unit of cavalry, just because I've got the elephants and I like putting elephants on the table. You know, so no doubt I'll be a sucker for Richard's million elephant army when it turns up. But realistically, I think you're better off without them, unless you were going for a pure Nan Zhao army. It's fun to use. I do find the, again, just from the one-off games I've had, I found those Foupe Guard can really, really damage people. And the fact you can just shove them into terrain as well, rough terrain. And you know, they're still superior long spear. You know, that's quite frightening in terrain. You know, for anything, pretty much anything short of a full fat Roman legionary.
It does have the feel of a Chinese version of a Roman army. Everything's flex. Cavalry's minor, but the cavalry's minor, but it is actually very good. It is the equivalent of your average melee expert equites.
Yes.
Yeah. So no. Definite thumbs up for me. I mean, we
definitely have a split there. Richard going, not really. Matt, yes. We'll leave it to the listeners to decide which of them they would sympathise most with. So, unless either of you got to say any more comments on that, I will move on to my second list. Shall I move on?
Please.
Yep, please.
Okay. As I said, I brought two completely separate lists. These aren't in any way a matched pair. But the second one is Angkor Empire. As I said, again, an army I have, an army I used a couple of times last year. Not this particular list, but I used it at Campaign and BritCon. And I think I can say I was pretty successful in both, especially BritCon, because I won it. I'm going to keep banging away on that till I ignominiously fail to defend my title this year, no doubt. So this is an army for some reason, I quite liked. I think I originally built one back way back, probably best part of 20 years ago when playing DBM, and redid it for Meg when I took up Meg. So again, it's another professional army, if you like. It's got professional generals. It's got four competent professional generals. Its terrain type is standard and jungle. And I've gone for a poor mobile camp. It can have unfortified or mobile. I had a few points left over, so upped it to the mobile. Just on that chance that you can, every now and then, move a camp. And we might all remember Richard's tale of a game he won because he was able to move a camp a couple of times and his opponent wasn't quite able to get there and break his army, and he broke his opponent's army. So, you know, and it's not a lot of points. Okay, so the actual army, I've got 2-3 base units of elephants, tribal loose, average protected, experienced bow, shove. And these ones come with the experienced bow. As I remember, I've always fielded with them. That a unit of Khmer cavalry formed loose, average protected, unskilled javelin, short spear, combat shy, four bases. That is really in there. These aren't compulsory, but they're in there because I wanted a sort of, if you like, a heavy skirmisher unit to possibly delay troops where necessary. So hence the combat shy, but I've not downgraded them to poor because I want to maintain the possibility of running away or evading as fast as far as they possibly can without the dice reduction you get with poor. Got a unit of guard foot, infantry, drilled loose, superior protected, short spear, melee expert, just six bases. That's the most you can have of those. Two six base units of Fakak armed foot. For those who want to know what Fakak is, it's a sort of two-handed weapon, axe-like weapon that's shaped a bit like a hockey stick with an axe blade sticking out of it. you can find the images of from Angkor Wat online. You'll probably be able to search for an image if you want of that. Anyway, these are drilled loose, average protected, experienced javelin, short spear, melee expert, and I've given them shoot and charge as well. I think the reality is these are units with a number of Fakak men rather than wholly Fakak men, because if I remember the illustrations, the Angkor Wat carvings, there are scattered amongst the troops are these people armed with these Fakaks. Anyway, basically it gives melee expert. Then I've got 2 8 base units of jacketed spearmen called. These are basically the regular army, drilled loose, average protected, experienced javelin, short spear, and again, shoot and charge. I've got 6 base unit of archers, drilled loose, average unprotected, experienced bow, but with pavise. 2 units of conscript spearmen. These are, there's compulsory 12 bases, so these are 2 units of 6. One is formed loose, average protected, unskilled javelin, short spear. The other is formed loose, poor protected, unskilled javelin, short spear, combat shy. So obviously that's been downgraded. Basically it's a filler unit. Got a unit of subject archers, tribal loose, poor unprotected, unskilled bow, combat shy. Again, a filler unit. And then possibly the signature unit for the Angkor Empire, are bolt shooters mounted on elephants. These are elephants, tribal loose, average protected, experienced bolt shooters. 3 bases they're off. You can have up to 3 bases like this, so that's 3 bases compulsory as far as I'm concerned. I've got nice, and the figures I've got, a nice little model with a big crossbow type piece of artillery on them. The army's rounded out by a unit of skirmishing archers, infantry skirmisher, poor unprotected, experienced bow, combat shy. Just like to point out that this list has changed a bit since I used it last at BritCon, because that I can now wear the t-shirt of Richard nerfed my competition winning army. but I have to say I agree with his changes, in that previously the Fakak armed foot were superior, and the jacketed spearmen could also have integral shooters as well as being experienced javelin, which, and certainly for the latter, that sort of double counting, a bit for Cacanthfoot, you are only allowed, if I remember rightly, 8 bases of them. So the fact, although they've lost the superiority, there's more bases of them now. So hence I've got 2 units of 6 rather than 1 of 8 that I previously had. I think in terms of using the army, I probably feel the loss of the integral shooters on the jacketed spearmen more than the change to the Fakak men. In use, I found it's an army. The elephants are really, really effective, but they are in threes, so you have to be a bit careful about throwing them in, and because of the nature of the army, it doesn't have stuff to screen them with much, and I'm not sure I want to because they've got the bow, so they can contribute to the shooting. I found in general, you know, obviously you've got your superior and or melee expert, 3 units of reasonably tough foot. They're not bad at standing even in the open against, say, cavalry. The fact they've got melee expert really, really works. And they're one of those troop types that when people have a bit of a punt at them and then find out they're a bit tougher than they thought they were going to be. And, you know, they've got experienced javelin. So, you know, you're getting that probably white dice as they come in as well. So even if you're down in the charge phase, you're getting probably getting two white dice, and that's equivalent to a green. And then you've got the melee expert in the prolonged melee as well. Obviously, giving everything shoot and charge gives you the option when you're piling in as well, because you're shooting with experienced javelin men. So I found in general, it's one of those, it was be a bit braver with the loose formation infantry than your opponent is going to expect you to be. And again, even like fighting close formation foot, basically don't worry too much about the fact that they might be giving shove, about getting shove. You know, it doesn't happen that often, hope, touch wood. And if it does, well, it does, doesn't it? Also, the other thing I would say about this army is for the bolt shooters mounted on elephants, there is, because they are bolt shooters, they can shoot overhead. I very rarely do that. It's another unit of elephant in the line. You know, don't be worried about fighting with them. But it is, I think it's also certainly an army that you want people to come onto you. It can be difficult to push onto somebody else. Anyway, that's the army. Richard and Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I like the Anchor army. And yeah, I have to say the bolt shooters mounted on elephants is, from a history point of view, somewhat suspect, because the images which show bolt shooters mounted on elephants may actually just refer to the army marching along and the transport of the bolt shooters before they were actually dismounted and deployed on their proper frames. But hey, it's something that's rather fun. So
it is. And I know exactly where you're coming from. I think that on at least one of the sculpture carvings, it can certainly be interpreted that they may be shooting it.
It's a possibility.
And a single unit of them isn't a game breaker, but it's really quite nice. They're really quite fun, and a bit of it, they can also be one of those people somewhat overreact to them.
Yeah, they're good in elephant versus elephant contests as well.
Yes. Yeah, they can give cataphracts a nightmare.
Yeah.
just Wang. And on that note, we'll bring Mr. Cataphract himself, Matthew, in on this one. As I bask in Richard's approval of this list.
I've always liked your lists for these, so there's no disagreement from there. I'm just thinking, frankly, whether you've got a bolt shooter on an elephant or not, my cataphracts are not happy about the elephant's full stop. I mean, the bolt shooter is just insult to injury, quite frankly. Although what actually is the insult to injury is, if I did actually charge my cataphracts at the elephants, one, it's stupid, but two, if you shoot me in, you don't get the +1 for shooting because you're not cavalry or chariots or camelry.
Lovely, isn't it?
Oh, it's just all those advantages for elephants. They're too cheap. You must up the price immediately.
those bolt shooters on elephants are 290 points each. You know, they are more significantly more expensive than other but
your
elephants.
And your experienced bow elephants are 260.
Yes.
So you're paying an extra 30 points for a bolt shooter with an 8-inch base.
Compared to the bow ones, yes, yeah. And of course, although the bolt shooter ones don't have shove, so you're not paying for that. But of course, they still get shatter in the charge phase.
Yeah. Just cheese all over it. I love it.
Thank you, Mr. Pot.
Yeah, I have no defense to that one, I'm afraid. No, I really like the army. My only, and it's my personal taste, I'd drop it down to 11 so I could have. No, actually, maybe. The sixes on some of the infantry worry me, but there again, some of them can't be in any more than sixes, so there's not much you can do about it. So, yeah, maybe
The Fakak Armfoot are, you can have up to 12 bases of them. So I think you're really talking about either having an 8 or 2 sixes.
2 sixes work far better, in my opinion. So,
I think so, yeah. In this particular army.
Yeah.
This is certainly my thinking on that, yeah. If you're going to drop to 11, well, you probably drop, well, some, I suppose you drop subject archers, you only get 100 points for that. You could drop the other archers. But I must admit, I have had great use, drilled experienced bow archers. You know, they might be unprotected, but again, they've got pervies if they're going to be shot at, so they're still effectively protected. I've just found because they're drilled, you can get them into positions to snipe away at people.
And again, the maximum you can have with pervades is 6, isn't it? So you don't gain anything there. Yeah, okay. It's almost as if you thought about it. So I'm going to take back my objection.
It is. In terms of Uggs, it's bigger than the version I used last year, which was 11, because I only had the single for cap. I don't think I had the subject archers, but because of other changes in there, you know, I've actually got more command. I only had 11 cards previously. I've now got 12. Which, given the army's bigger, it needs it as well. So,
but all that drilled makes it really manoeuvrable.
In terms of card
count as well.
Yeah,
do a lot for very low cards.
And also, it's something which I can't remember if any of the other armies we've touched on so far has. This one can benefit from the Elephant Kings. So, that came in this year. So the generals can fight and give a +1 bonus with elephants.
Only in their own command, though, before people...
I'd miss that little bit of subtlety. And also, on the off chance you had a legendary general, they only still give you +1.
They only give a +1, yes.
I remember that bit. But that's a difference from last time, you know. I think so every time I've used...
You can't take a general who's lost all the troops in other commands and
just tack him,
stick them onto the elephant.
Tack him on, so yeah. Yeah, and that's a different for, you know, for... Yes. And I was just checking the notes did say that, to prove that I had missed it. I was really trying to catch Richard out, wasn't I? But he's way ahead of me.
I haven't actually seen anybody play that Elephant King's rule yet, so something to look forward to.
To look forward to, indeed. Yes, yeah. I think despite that in their command one, I would generally be looking to float the CNC in this one. I generally found it was very useful, and it allows you to maximise the use of those six drilled units.
Oh, I think being able to drop 3 extra cards on a single command when you know your point of attack is massive.
Yeah, it can be, yes. It is. Right. Okie dokie. Well, again, unless I've got anything to say, we let us move on because we have 2 more lists to go through, provided by Richard.
So I've done something a little bit different with this. I chose a Kingdom of Pagan army. And then I've taken a Yuan Dynasty army that I think would be historic for that, the invasion of Pagan. and seeing what it might look like. So these aren't necessarily top competition armies, but they were there to take a look at the matchup, really. So first off, let's go with the Kingdom of Pagan. 4809 is the army number in the Southeast Asia book. It has a poor unfortified camp in my version, and you can have any. Well, I've gone for 1275 as the date, so I can have any generals. So I've gone for a talented professional and then three instinctive sub-generals, one talented and two mediocre. The talented professional ups the PBS and the scouting compared to the instinctive, and I think that gives it a little bit of help. The army itself consists of 10 tugs, three tugs of elephants and escorts. I've got the superior protective experience bow shove in tugs of three, a guard cavalry unit of six, formerly superior protected unskilled javelin short spear, so they're quite meaty. A guard swordsman unit, infantry drilled loose, superior protected melee expert, eight of those. Guard crossbowman, drilled loose, average unprotected skilled crossbow, six of those. Two units of standing army spearmen who are form loose, average protected, unskilled javelin and short spear. A unit of archers who are tribal loose, average unprotected, experienced bow, eight of those. And some standing army cavalry who are average unprotected, sorry, average protected, unskilled javelin, short spear, those being formed loose, and six of those. So you get your 10 tugs. As mentioned, this army also gets the Elephant King's rule. 9986 points. So that's your pagan Burmese.
Looks quite direct, say the
Yeah,
least.
probably.
Yeah, so yeah, half of it's superior,
Yeah,
literally.
most of it can shoot. To some extent.
Yeah, as it with the elephants, the escorts, is that a compulsory experience boat on there?
I think it probably is for
Yeah,
the
it
Burmese.
is. Yeah.
I'm just a bit of me just wonders, superior and the bowman doing two jobs,
Possibly.
you know, for.
Yeah, because I can't imagine anybody's going to voluntarily charge those things, so you're not even going to get to shoot them in. But
Yeah, and then you have to prompt them in because they're missile
yeah.
focused. You know, it's so with the, yeah, but obviously in my Angkor list, they got bows with the elephants, and but they're average, and so you maybe a bit more incentive to sit back and shooty 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 to try and get people to charge you these ones. Well, but then again, if it's compulsory, it's compulsory. So it wasn't an army list choice. It just comes with the
Yeah,
army, doesn't it?
maybe they should have the option of shoot and charge in future armies.
Oh, God.
I wish I'd never mentioned it already.
Shoot and charge with a general in the front rank and superior. Ah, what could go wrong?
That's it. You thought it was fun. Yeah, I think you stated the obvious. The elephants will attract missile fire like nobody's business.
But that superior means that, skilled shooters are not as effective. Not that, yeah, you want to
But they are
still
still
not.
three base units.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to risk it.
You know, it's
Yeah.
Now,
Could play with.
I was thinking using this, I'd mix the elephants in with the foot.
Yeah.
And as you say, the couple of mediocre instinctive generals are obvious candidates for fighting with the elephants.
Yes. Yeah, I suppose even if they get killed, the elephants themselves are just starting on the white dice, aren't they? So
Indeed. So,
it's
anyway.
the effect of the. Yeah, no, actually, it's interesting. Again, it's one of those. I just look at it and go, it just looks small.
Yeah, as you said, it's very direct. I think with a bit of terrain, it would be very hard to kill.
It could be. You know, it's definitely one of those that if it hits you coherently, you know, those three units of elephants, all each led by a general, could really, really make your day go downhill very quickly.
Interspersed with superior infantry.
Yeah. One of which is, and the skilled crossbowmen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
he's growing on you. Slowly.
Well, put it this way, the more I look at it, the less I want to fight it. Yeah, so, you know.
I'd still take my Angkor army over it, and probably the Niger.
Yeah,
it's but again, you know, it's one of those. It's yeah, I think, you know, there is the psychological impact of 9 bases of superior elephants. You know, you can cause paralysis in your opponent with those. So, you know,
indeed.
Okay, and the other one
is so by Wan Dynasty. Now, this is not a Wan Dynasty army I'd expect to see in competition.
But I think we can agree with that.
it's a bit different. It'd certainly surprise your opponent if you took this as a Wan Dynasty.
It surprised me when I opened the file.
There you go.
It worked on that basis.
So I've given it 4 competent professional generals. It has a poor unfortified camp, 7 PBS and 3 scouting, which tells you it probably isn't a normal Huan army. So it starts off best Mongol cavalry. Well, I downgraded these. So these are cavalry drilled loose, average protected experience, bow, short spear, because the cavalry suffered in the jungles in the south of China. Southern tribal cavalry, form flexible, average protected experience, crossbow, short spear, melee expert. So yeah, they're actually reasonably worthwhile. Chinese guard, drill close, superior protected pole arm, 8 of those.
I like that.
Spear and swordsman, drilled flexible, average protected pole arm, 8 of those. 2 lots of 8 crossbowmen, drilled loose, average protected experience, crossbow. So again, no combat shy, so quite capable of fighting. Mm-hmm. Then supported by southern auxiliaries, tribal loose, average protected experience, javelin, short spear, 9 of those. And then 2 tugs of 6. Provincial spearmen, infantry, form flexible, poor protected pole arm. The army has to have at least a third of the tugs, other than the southern auxiliaries, as poor, hence the provincial spearmen.
The infantry then, tugs.
Infantry tugs, indeed. Then, along with that, some fairly meaty sugs. So we've got bolt shooters, 2 lots of 2 average unprotected experience bolt shooters. So if I'm going to be fighting those superior elephants, bolt shooters might be worthwhile. Then skirmishing archers, average unprotected experience bow combat shy. Skirmishing crossbowmen, average unprotected experience crossbow combat shy, 2 units of 6. And then fire tube infantry, skirmisher poor, unprotected, unskilled firearm. Just a bit of fun.
Why not?
You never know, they might slow something down, and they're only 114 points.
Yeah.
And then a unit of skirmishing cavalry, poor, unprotected, experienced bow. That boosts the scouting as well. So it's definitely not your typical Huan Dynasty army, but it shows that the list can produce something that you could perhaps believe sort of would have struggled through the jungles of Burma to fight the pagan, and would make an interesting matchup in terms of a contest, because I couldn't tell you which one might win.
if Jan can get the bolt shooters in front of the elephants.
Might struggle, but you might also force the elephants into a particular deployment, which yes. they might not be, and you might be able to take advantage of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is definitely different for Jan. Definitely, it's and you know, as I said, with Matt's in the context of sort of the match pair. Yeah, and I think it makes a really interesting pair, and it's not a terrible army.
Oh, I think I've seen worse on the table. Well, I've used it.
<table. laughs> I certainly have. Yeah, yeah. It's and you know, as you said, you know, you got the 8 superior guard, the 8 other pole arm, the 2/8 of crossbow. That's pretty chunky.
All drilled, so all nice yeah. and maneuverable. Competent professional generals to whiz them around.
Mm-hmm. I'm very drawn by those Southern tribal cavalry. That's almost a unique unit, isn't it?
I noticed those as well. Protected, experienced crossbow, short spear, and melee expert. They're quite nice.
Yes.
I think yeah. I've got a feeling they're only available in China.
on the ground, yeah, well, they're southern, so they probably, you know, they wouldn't be, probably wouldn't be out on the steppe or anything with the northern end of Yuan. So, you know, they are rather nice.
Yes, the Yuan army has quite a lot of complicated options depending on where you're located and yeah. dates. So, that's my suspicion.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, the one list is one I've never really come up with a satisfactory list for.
No, it's another classic frustration list.
I haven't restricted the Southern Tribal Cavalry to.
But you haven't.
They are restricted to China, but they are only available from 1275.
Okay.
Because the infantry, the Southern Tribal Infantry is the same. They're not restricted. The only ones that are restricted look to be the Gantulu Looters, which in itself's worth having at least a unit of those on the table. Unprotected short spear, devastating charger, combat shy. That's just hilarity.
And 30 points each. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can have 2 units of 9.
Yeah. Sign me up.
I might suggest that maybe we should add the Southern Tribal Troops is something else that maybe just needs a quick look at. Because I think there was a distinct difference with Yuan armies between the North and South. Yeah, especially because most of the Mongols were in the North. Anyways, no great rush. No, I think that's I think with both of you, the match pairs you brought would have really interesting battles. So I think that is.
That's really good. A unit of cavalry. You've got to have best Mongol cavalry 6 of, and you've got to have Mongol cavalry.
Oops, have I?
Oh, the Southern Tribals might have to morph into Mongols.
They might indeed. Oops. Yeah, I didn't spot that.
Never mind. It's been a while since we've had a. Isn't that illegal moment? But I'm sure. In terms of you just replace them. Okay, there might be something like form flexible, unprotected, skilled bow, short spear, possibly melee expert if you wanted it. Would be a 6 of Mongol straight Mongol cavalry, wouldn't it? Or if you wanted to downgrade the bows because on the they're not doing so well.
The tribals are 159. The Mongol cavalry with melee expert would be 150.
Yeah,
and still skilled.
Yes.
So and you can add dismantable to that actually if you wanted to take them as
right. So you could do a straight swap and
yeah,
it wouldn't be that much of a different army. Be pity though, because those
Yeah, those tribal.
Those tribals are quite nice, aren't they? Yeah. Yeah. This is a comment on the Iron Army is a sort of general point. One thing that does seem to get people is the downgrade a third of the infantry to poor.
Yeah. And the Ming one's the same, isn't it?
I think so, yes. Yeah, it just seems to be one of those things that you just go, oh, if only.
Yeah, the later Ming list also has the same restriction, yes, and that, as I'm sure you're the same, Nick, that's one that list checkers often run across because people forget them.
It is, yeah, it's just the oops one. Hokey dokey.
Mm.
Well, I think maybe we should wrap up the list there, and maybe we should just, I think we've got enough time just to look at some of the listeners' questions. That come in. We thought it was successful last time asking for people who've got any questions related to the podcast subject we were going to do. So we did again, and we've got a few questions in. One of them we've already answered, because on the WhatsApp group, Hoob asked about, I think it was the Kingdom of Pagan and the Angkor Empire lists. How would you construct an army? Well, we've done both of those today, Hoop, so look at those, see what you think, maybe that. So in terms of other questions, I've got a sort of generic question from Gavin Pearson, for the PDF. The armies covered by the PDF is, how much evidence is there for the troop types and proportion? Now, he's saying he's asking because he doesn't know, and then Richard had already commented about sources earlier. So I suppose all of these will probably come down to you, Richard, at least to start with, you know, the amount of evidence that's available.
I have to confess, I mean, the Southeast Asia is not an area of expertise for me. So in terms of books that I'm aware of, one of the most useful, for example, for Burma, I actually had, is the Armies of Medieval Burma, which was written by Daniel Mersey for Outpost War Game Services back in 1999.
Yeah.
Which was also, I've been supported by various articles in Slingshot as well, which were pointed out to me. Sources there have been, at least I've got some material. When it comes to Khmer, there is a lot of detail from the reliefs at Angkor Wat and elsewhere, which are readily accessible and provide some good evidence for the Khmer armies. For the Vietnamese armies, I've not done any research at all, and I have to admit, at the moment, I'm not particularly aware of much information that is widely available on Vietnamese armies. So that's something see if I can find out about.
I'd agree on the sources. You know, so I've done a bit of searching to put some possibles up in the show notes on this one. I haven't really come up with very much. Obviously, as I said earlier on, you know, we're looking at it from an Anglophone point of view. I suspect there is material in French, given the French colonial interests in the area as well, that I certainly wouldn't be able to access, given my inability with most languages, probably including English. So I think in terms of sort of one-stop shops, there is very little. I suspect you could spend an awful long time searching through, say, academia online, and finding papers that might have the odd thing in here and there. But I think it's probably quite a difficult one overall, for certainly for the English speaking world. So there we are, Gavin. not that much we can help you on. By mentioning the Dan Mersey book, actually, you've answered Bruce Norbeck, on Facebook, asked about that. And I think somebody did mention that particular book, which I don't think is available these days. One, because Outpost unfortunately ceased trading when the owner passed away. It was very much a small publication done by them, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's actually a sort of bound thing like you used to get in offices. So it's not even a sort of professionally bound book. But yeah. I'm fortunate to have a copy. I don't know. I've not seen another one available, I must admit.
Okay. We had
on the question on the number of men per elephant, which I think Bruce also asked.
Yes.
I believe the 16 men per elephant, I think, came from a description from Marco Polo. And as Bruce already commented, I think it's widely discredited. It is feasibly, just about feasible, to load 16 archers onto an elephant. But as a fighting platform, it doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense. And it's more likely that actually the elephants were accompanied part of that sort of number rather than the men actually being mounted on an elephant. The weight loading would have some serious consequences for the stamina of the elephant as well.
Makes sense. Again, on the WhatsApp, Roger Whitten asked about those Burmese elephants, about the large archer crews, presumably thinking of that 16 man. Basically asking, is the shooting represented effectively enough?
I think the shooting with elephants in Meg is actually doesn't necessarily reflect just the crew on the elephant, but the skirmishers escorting the elephants. So I don't think I would particularly be concerned about that particular point. Because the number of shooters on the elephant may be dwarfed by the number of shooters in the sort of troops accompanying the elephant.
So essentially, if you wanted a better shooting capability, you'd have to prove the elephant was being escorted by exceptionally effective shooters rather than the numbers on the elephant.
Indeed, I think so.
Yeah. And last question we got is from Richard Balizowski, the new Mr. Lurkio, in terms of selling the figures. And he's asking, what extent did the Chinese and Mongol dominance at various times affect the military and culture of these South Asian dynasties and their armies?
I think the short answer in terms of the Mongols is very little. The Mongols, as I say, did not have a particularly good track record in Southeast Asia because it really wasn't their sort of terrain, let's put it like that in Wargamers terms. The Chinese probably had a larger cultural influence in Vietnam than anywhere else in China, and in fact it's probably the migration of the Thai from southern China into Southeast Asia that actually probably has a bigger influence. And in fact probably a greater cultural influence actually comes from India, via the maritime route than it actually does from China itself.
There we are. So despite their often headline billing, nil point to the Mongols. Too many trees, too much jungle, too many nasty microbes.
Indeed. I mean, they had some success in sacking the pagan kingdom, but overall, they didn't dominate the area compared to their conquests in Asia and extending the Far East as Europe. Far West as Europe, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, Richard. Thank you for answering some questions on top of everything else you've done. I think we're coming to the end of this now. So we've hit the sort of the any other business, upcoming things or things people think our listeners ought to know about. Richard, you've got your hand on the pulse on these things and remember bits that I don't.
Well, I was at Salute Show
of course
last weekend with the Society of Ancient stand, as it happens, which seemed to prove very popular in terms of numbers. And there seemed to be more traders present than there had been in previous years. That was certainly my impression. And I certainly enjoyed myself. Coming up, I guess the big event for Meg competitions will be Campaign, which will be held in the 11th and 12th of May, I think it is.
That weekend, yes.
At Milton Keynes Shopping Centre, which is always a fun event, I think, which the public can get to see what we do. Not that they would think us weird by any means, I'm sure.
No.
The other thing I will mention is that I am planning to run a Pacto campaign weekend, or well, day, actually, at Colours at Newbury in September. Okay. Following the success of our Pacto event last year. So if anybody is interested in that, they're welcome to contact me and more details will come nearer the time.
Is that about mid-September?
It's usually something like the second week of September.
Okay,
Newbury Racecourse.
Because the first weekend in September is Chariots of Fire. And I know that because that's the nearest weekend to my annual getting older weekend. So, well, I'll say now I'm definitely interested in the Colours one. Colours with you
14th of September.
Excellent. Excellent. So that doesn't clash. Yeah. Because I say, I remember going to Colours last year when with the SOA, we were showing Meg off there. That was a good fun weekend. It was a good fun day. It's a one day show. It was a very hot day, as I remember.
Yes, it was warm. So my plan, if all things go accordingly, is to actually base the campaign on the Barbarian Conspiracy of 367, where the Romans are facing off the Atticotti, Scotti, Picts and Saxons.
Yes, indeed.
And to run that using the map from Saxon Shore is Burning, which is a Society of Ancients publication.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yep, I'm definitely up for that. It's late antiquity, so it's a period I'm interested in as well. Ticks a lot of boxes for me, that one. So, indeed. Matt, have you got anything you think needs passing on to our listeners?
Same weekend as the campaign, for those not doing campaign, is Havoc on the Hamble, which the two Ians are running down our way. Myths and Legends, bring a legendary general, basically. I think they want at least one more player to even the numbers up. So if anybody's around and available, and if you don't have an army, drop Ian a note. I'm sure one of us will have something you can borrow.
Yeah. And when you say down our way, that's the sort of north of Southampton, isn't it?
Yes, it's between
Sarisbury Green, which is between Fareham and Southampton.
There you go.
There you go. So there's a sort of a, is that one day?
It is one day. It's three games over one day. I will be running my Aztecs, so come along and see me get my butt kicked across various tables.
and then after that, I will just mention the 1st and 2nd of June at Battlefield Hobbies. I'm running a more conventional competition, make competition, 2 days, 4 games. Westernish medieval armies between 1204 and 1384, which I think makes it the only sort of high medievalish competition we've got in the calendar this year. So, but also set the dates just to be a little bit different. But you can get your tickets from Battlefield Hobbies there. Usual sort of deal on that. So, in that case, I think we've probably reached a logical end. So, thank you as ever to Richard and Matt, especially Richard for his history notes and answering the questions. We keep getting him to do more and more, you've noticed. but yeah, thank you to that. And thank you to the listeners who gave us questions as well. I think, you know, it adds a little bit to the show. And on that note, I will say goodbye.